love toilet paper. It was just another shift on, really, to start eating Seventh-day Adventist pamphlets.
The reality of life with Tourette's is much funnier than this.
I can't shake the feeling that the whole city is a facade.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Jess Hamilton, and this week we've got something a little different on the show. At All the Best, we love celebrating and showcasing great Australian audio. So today we're handing over the show to our friends at Contact Mic. It's a monthly podcast made in Melbourne about the things that make us human, like moments of change, indecision, and contact.
Would you mind telling us how you made money during this trip? Supposedly, perhaps, how you might have made money.
Yeah, we might have made money, had the opportunity presented. Well, we smuggled a man who the authorities were after in one particular country.
Fleur Kilpatrick, Sarah Walker and Kieran Ruffles are the brains behind it. And to give you a good sense of what they do, we're going to give you a Contact Mic tasting platter. We're playing three excerpts from three episodes, but don't worry, we'll direct you to where you can catch each episode in full as we go. So let's get into it. First up, there are a lot of things that our bodies do that are mostly outside of our control. Blinking, breathing, our hearts beating. For Jess Tom, there's also saying biscuit, or hedgehog, or thumping her chest hard over and over. This excerpt is from episode 10 of Contact Mic. Here's Jess.
There's so many people on YouTube who pretend to have Tourette's. Biscuit, and actually one of the motivating factors for creating Tourette's Hero was I watched a video that had almost 30 million views, Biscuit, of someone pretending to have Tourette's and swearing, Biscuit. And I just thought, I watched it and I thought, oh my God, everybody watching this video, Biscuit, is being shortchanged. The reality of life with Tourette's is much funnier than this. I can't remember a time where I haven't laughed at, you know, doing things in a different way. Biscuit, I think I haven't always found that, Biscuit, easy to be open about or share. Biscuit, but laughter has been an incredibly important tool for me in managing challenges from when I was young. I understand myself as a disabled person, Biscuit, using the social model of disability, which is a concept for thinking about disability that says that people aren't disabled by their impairments, so the things that make them different, Biscuit, but by a collective failure to consider difference in how society is organised, Biscuit. So it's not my body or my tics that disable me, Biscuit, but non-accessible environments or structures or attitudes, Biscuit. Biscuit, hedgehog, Biscuit, the exciting thing about that is if we change those structures, if we consider difference in how things we set things up, then we can make people less disabled.
Jess experiences the effects of social disability pretty regularly.
One of the big challenges of living with a condition like Tourette's is its unpredictability, Biscuit, but even more so is the unpredictable reactions. Biscuit, I understand, Biscuit, that if you haven't seen tics before, they can look unusual and people want to look or might have questions. Biscuit, I think times when I found that most difficult, Biscuit, have been times where I've explained that I've had Tourette's, Biscuit, and people haven't listened, particularly people in positions of authority, Biscuit. And I've had several experiences with people who are operating transport systems, Biscuit, or the police, where they've pulled me up because my behaviour looks different, Biscuit. I've then explained that I have Tourette's, Biscuit, and they then haven't felt able to back down or change in response to that information. So like I've had police officers say things like, that's fine, but you can't behave like that here. And it's like, well, like that's not a choice. So you're saying that I can't be here. Biscuit, I had a difficult experience on the London Underground underground train network there, Biscuit, where my ticket hadn't worked to get out of the station and I approached a member of staff asking for help to get out, Biscuit, and he turned away from me, Biscuit, and so I approached him again. I explained that I have Tourette's and he refused to help me until I stopped making noise and stopped swearing, Biscuit. I explained again that I had Tourette's, Biscuit, and again he walked away from me and I was left, Biscuit, on this concourse unable to get out, and again I cried and I just shouted, Biscuit, into the station concourse, this man, like, I'm stuck here and this man isn't helping me, and I was crying and a woman came over and helped to mediate that, Biscuit. But it was That was a really difficult moment for me, Biscuit, because it was threatening my independence. It's like I can't feel safe. I feel at risk because people are ready to make judgments, but they're not ready to listen. I mean, I'm rubbish at suppressing dicks, Biscuit. At times in my life, I have had more ability to suppress than I have now, Biscuit, and I used to try and save them up and let them out in the toilet. Lots of people with Tourette's traps try and disguise them, or I've heard children talk about dropping things on the floor so they can go under the table to tick under the table. Biscuit, all of those strategies and effort and energy, Biscuit, takes a lot of thought and time, and all of that is then when you're not focusing on school, Biscuit, or art, or enjoyment, or friends, or family, Biscuit. And I think it's much better that we try and create spaces where everyone has permission to be themselves and can feel safe to be themselves, whoever that might be. And that goes way beyond just thinking about tics. But the answer is, like, the ability to suppress is very individual. Some people can do it for a long time, Biscuit, but that can have a negative impact on people's well-being.
What's your relationship with your body like today?
Biscuit, I'm pretty happy with it, Biscuit. I feel confident in it. I mostly understand how it works, Biscuit. It likes to surprise me, Biscuit. Biscuit, Tourette's is a condition that goes up and down in the course of someone's life. It's not all downhill, but it's a roller coaster, Biscuit. And sometimes you just get used to one set of tics, and another set will present themselves, and that can be a real shock, Biscuit. And it can be really difficult for people around you to understand and adapt to those changes too, Biscuit, Hedgehog. But I feel very happy in myself and in my skin and in my body, Biscuit, most of the time, Biscuit. I'm actually, in the last few days I've been extra wiggly, Biscuit, and I've had many more motor tics than perhaps I have had in recent months, and that's been a new challenge for me, and I've had to almost relearn certain things that had become quite routine. So, like, how I transfer on and off the toilet was like, this needs a bit of a rethink. Biscuit, and I think for me, Biscuit, the thing that I hold on to with all of that is that there hasn't been a tick that I can think about, Biscuit, or a situation that I haven't been able to overcome with a bit of creative thinking and planning and thought and discussion, Biscuit. And I've got lots of people I can draw on for that, Biscuit. And so for me, when there's any tick or challenge, it's not about saying, what's this stopping me from doing, but what can we do to limit the impact of this or make something possible? One of the ideas that really shifted my thinking was, Biscuit, reading something written by another disabled comedian, Biscuit, and connecting with the idea, Biscuit, that independence, Biscuit, doesn't have to mean doing everything for yourself. It doesn't have to mean making your own cup of tea, Biscuit, because that doesn't work great for me. Independence is about being in control of your decisions and your choices, Biscuit, and asking for help when you need it is part of being independent.
Over the years, Jess's relationship to Tourette's has changed. Today, Tourette's is an enormous source of creativity in her life.
And I used to find it really difficult to talk about Tourette's without tears. Biscuit, Hedgehog, Biscuit. But then I had a conversation with my friend Matthew, Biscuit, in which he described Tourette's as a crazy language-generating machine, Biscuit, and told me that not doing something creative with my tics would be wasteful, Biscuit. And we'd had loads of conversations about Tourette's and about creativity before, Biscuit, but for some reason I was able to hear that sentence in a different way than I'd heard everything else before, and it pierced my consciousness and enabled me to connect and start actually thinking about what I could do that would be to utilise this source of spontaneous creativity that I have access to.
That story is taken from October's episode 16,000 Biscuits. Jess Tom is the founder of Tourette's Hero, and you can hear more about her tics in all of their infuriating, brilliant, creative, and subversive reality at contactmicpodcast.com. Next up, we travel back to the middle of the year for an excerpt from episode 6. In June, the Contact Mike team were spread across the globe, and so that month's episode, Black Cross, featured a selection of audio postcards from around the world.
This month in your world, in Adelaide, my niece and I talked about controlled burnings.
First, it made the plants grow.
We were colouring in at the time. You can hear the pencils.
Yeah, I feel scared if it does. Because sometimes fire is quite dangerous.
Sometimes, yeah. But you know, we have a fire in our house at night sometimes, and that's not dangerous.
No, because it's in the fireplace.
It's in the fireplace. It stays exactly where it's meant to, and those fires in the bush, they stay exactly where they're meant to as well.
But what if they suddenly explode everywhere?
Well, then the men and women who fight fires, they would come and look after it, and they'd put it out.
With lots of hoses and water.
With lots of hoses and water, and they'd make sure that everyone was as safe as possible.
Safe as they could be.
I'm just going to go and check something, my darling. Can you see here the microphone is recording in front of you?
Okay.
Is there a secret you want to tell the microphone while I'm away?
Microphone. Imagine when you're as old as you can get. Imagine when you're dead. Microphone, imagine when you're dead.
Tell the secret?
Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I told the microphone, imagine when you're dead.
Why did you ask the microphone to imagine when it was dead?
Because I wanted to know that it would one day be dead.
Oh. And then we went back to colouring dinosaurs.
There you go.
Thank
one
you.
Blue tail.
Do you want to colour in this last bit of its spine with the blue as well?
Yep, I'd love to.
Dear Fleur and Sarah, someone told my travelling companion, Fergs, on a previous visit that Manila is dirty but cool. I guess that's their version of Berlin's poor but sexy. We got off our red-eye flight from Kuala Lumpur at 4 a.m, found our way to the centrally located hostel in a entertainment district, and promptly crashed, setting up our body clocks for what has been mostly a nocturnal pattern. We played our first show that night, and I made some of the new friends who would be my people for my time here. The next night we took an Uber for an hour and 25 minutes to see a Melbourne theatre maker perform a solo show in a packed little restaurant bar. And I saw a local performer who had come to Melbourne for a show 2 years before. When I said I had seen him and remembered the name of the show to him, he was surprised. I said to him, "Well, you know, it's a big planet, but it's still a small world." When I messaged a friend saying I was seeing our mutual acquaintance perform in a city thousands of clicks from where we had all met, her message was simple. "Wow. Tell him I love him." And I did. And he smiled. Barely a day later, I was sharing the back seat of an SUV with a new friend on another of the seemingly interminable car trips that have defined the texture of this city for me. And we got to talking about Melbourne. She said she'd met someone from there when they were both living in Manchester, and of course it turned out I knew him too. Big planet, small world. And when I messaged him to say who I was with and where, his response was simple. "Wow. Tell her I love her." And I did. And she smiled. Traveling and making new friends, the people that I will talk about when I bump into their mutual acquaintances in some as yet unknown third location, has made me think all the more of the people I would send that message to. And how sometimes it takes an agent of chance to mediate that simple, essential message. Tell him I love him. Tell her I love her. On my last night here, I will not only perform myself, but I will go to see a contemporary dance show at the National Cultural Centre. You see, I recognised the European choreographer at the packed little restaurant bar, We'd met briefly in the foyer of a dance venue in Melbourne and had mutual friends. We exchanged emails, and the rest is, well, travel. Big planet, small world.
Dear Fleur and Kieran, it's the 18th of June and I have a cold. I'm in Vienna. It's beautiful here. Walking in from the station, I had the sudden realization that the cities I've been imagining when I read Italo Calvino novels, they're all here. They're all Vienna, and I never knew it. My brain built this city from those words, and now I'm walking through it, and it feels strange and dreamlike. Vienna's full of art and architecture and history, but what it doesn't seem to be full of is people. I've been walking around these streets for days, and even though there are huge multi-story apartment buildings everywhere, there doesn't seem to be anyone in them. I can't shake the feeling that the whole city is a facade, that there's nothing behind those windows at all. I was sitting in the museum's quarter this evening, and I heard some music outside. And I walked through an archway and round a corner, and I found where all the people in Vienna were. They were on the street, tens of thousands of them holding balloons and rainbow flags, and I realised that I'd stumbled into the biggest pride march I've ever seen. Everyone was going in the same direction, so I just started walking with them, and everyone was smiling. People were dancing and singing and kissing and laughing and just beaming at one another. Even the family I passed, who are all wearing t-shirts saying, "I love Jesus," were smiling. At one point, I was lost in my own thoughts, looking at all the signs saying, "We are Orlando, we are Orlando," and someone took my hand. I looked up, and this beautiful, sleepy-eyed boy pulled me up onto the tray of a truck, put his arms around me, and just cuddled me. He kissed the palm of my hand, and I wished him a beautiful day and vanished back into the smiling crowd as the setting sun lit up all the rainbow flags so that they glowed gold.
Those stories were taken from episode 6. You can find the rest of the postcard episode on the Contact Mike website. You're listening to All the Best, but you're actually listening to stories from one of our favourite podcasts, Contact Mike. We've handed the show over to them for this week to feature some of their best pieces. Imagine the phone rings and a man you hardly know asks you to drive across the country, jump on a boat and sail off into the unknown with nothing but a grumpy goose for company. What do you do? Our last piece today is from an episode about what can happen when you just say yes.
How long were you sailing around the world with a goose for?
Well, you probably shouldn't talk about Russell like that. I assume you're referring to his comrade, which was Vasco da Gama, which was the white goose.
Liz is elusive about some of the details here. When we ask how Russell came to be sailing about with a goose, she just said he was that kind of guy.
It was very much a love-hate relationship. Because if you're in a storm and you're sailing around, and you're at the helm and you've got this goose suddenly decides, actually, it's quite scary. I need to be near somebody, even if I hate her guts. And he'd sneak up and get right beside you as the score went over. So you'd be helming there with this sweet little goose sitting beside you. You think, oh, you're not that bad. You're not that bad, Vasco. And then as soon as the score finished, you'd go, right, that's enough. And he'd just bite you. Yeah, he was a bit of a prick, actually.
But Vasco had his moments. There was the time the Seventh-day Adventists came calling.
I think they must have been justifying why they had a very flash little runabout boat. And they'd come alongside Bob when it was moored beside the Brisbane Gardens there. And I saw who it was. I thought, I'm not going on topsides. I'll just pretend I'm not here. And you could look out the little porthole without them seeing you. And they were hanging onto the side of the boat, knocking on the boat like they say, "Anybody home?" And I thought, yes. And then I could hear the little of Vasco's feet going from one side of the... He must have been sleeping on the sunny side of the deck. And you could hear his feet coming around. And as he was coming around, they were getting faster and faster like this. And I just saw the portholes right here. I could see the hand and the pamphlet. I heard them say, "Oh, look!" And then you see this goose's head come in and bite the hand, take the pamphlet, eat the pamphlet in a really angry way.
No religion.
Don't touch the
boat
and don't leave that pamphlet. Because he loved toilet paper, so he, it was just another
Shift On really to start eating Seventh-day Adventist pamphlets.
But Vasco wasn't good at open waters. He'd fall off the back of the boat and just swim in circles until they turned around and came back for him. So they left the goose on a farm and headed out into the ocean. Just the two of them and Bob.
Nature is different without us in it. We're so used to seeing animals fleeing before us, but Liz saw parts of the world where animals had never learnt to fear.
I've never been close to a turtle. I don't mean emotionally, physically. Diving down to see a turtle, you know, you've seen its surface, you think, oh, I'll go down and have a look, so you dive in. And here it is going about its business, finding things to eat. And this one just looked at me, and you could see it go, God, you're ugly, and then go back to what it was doing. Oh, crap, a human. I'd jump overboard with my spear gun, and I'd just be surrounded by all these fish going, hi, what are we doing today? And I couldn't even push them far enough away to spear them. So it's like, that's not sporting, guys. But back to the sailing. We had a really bad sail across from the Chagos Islands. We got caught in very big storms, the biggest seas I'd ever seen. And I think I actually had scurvy. I don't know. I've never looked up the symptoms, but something happened. I was not well. It's because we hadn't eaten for days because of the difficulties. The boat had been knocked down. There were things. It had obviously been knocked down, you know, horizontal a couple of times. And the waves were enormous. And we finally got in behind Madagascar and came into the first bay that was safe. And suddenly you've gone out of these terrible conditions and we're exhausted beyond words probably, but just functioning okay. So we came into that bay. Again, it was like Lady Musgrave Island, completely glassy smooth. And it was absolutely full of manta rays. And they were just doing whatever manta rays do. Just amazing. Clear water watching these manta rays, and they were thick. There would have been hundreds of them. I don't think that's a very common thing to see.
While in Madagascar, they were able to trade with the local villagers.
We bought some eggs off them, and they came over in a tatty old plastic bag, you know, plastic bags that had been out in the sun and start to break down. And so they handed over the eggs, and they speak a kind of a French dialect. And we had a smattering of things that just get us into trouble, really. But we were trying, like, so what do you want? What do you actually want? What do they want, Russell? I don't know. They wanted their bag back. They wanted their precious plastic bag back. So once I realised that, I said, plastic bags? Whoa, we've got plastic bags. I gave them another plastic bag. And they were just so excited to get a plastic bag.
What was it like to be just with one person as your human companion for that whole time?
I think it speeds up a relationship. So he's a very intense fellow, interesting guy, like very good company, but very intense. And it'd be like having a 45-year relationship to be with somebody on a boat for 5 years. And if you got pissed off, like I did, I'd go up the top of the mast, you'd be out at the middle of the sea, and I'd go up the top, never coming down ever again, because there was nowhere else to go. So if you had any issues, you had to sort it out because you couldn't run away. It's not like the glossy brochures, though. It's actually really hard work.
Would you mind telling us how you made money during this trip?
Supposedly, perhaps. How you might have made money.
Yeah, we might have made money, had the opportunity presented. Well, we smuggled a man who the authorities were after in one particular country.
They were in Borneo, moored in a bay, when some locals rowed over and asked a favour. Could they get a man out of the country? Fast.
He was so not streetwise. He just had no idea. He's like, you kind of felt sorry for him. He had a bag full of cash, and he just wanted to get out of Borneo and get to the Philippines. He didn't care where.
Why he wanted to get out was unclear. Perhaps something about claiming his children's school fees when they weren't going to a private school, something like that.
So he's negotiating down inside the boat with Russell, and I'm standing behind him so he can't see me and Russell can. I've got my arms folded and I'm frowning and I'm going, don't you dare, you know, just miming it, don't you dare. And then the guy says, I'll give you $11,000 American. And I'm going, yeah, all right. Now you're talking. He did. He gave us $11,000 cash just to get him out overnight to another country. We were quite well armed when we left Australia because we'd been told of all these pirates. I told you that story, didn't I? We had a Ruger, a very accurate, very good gun, apparently, with telescopic sights and accurate over several hundred metres.
and we're heading out into the Pacific, and we've got the Philippines somewhere on the left, but we can't see it. There's no land in sight. And then on the horizon, you see this quite large open boat, very, very fast. And when it turned to face us, it was a very narrow hull with two outriggers, and it would have been 60 foot long. It was very big. And you could see the rooster tails coming off it as it charged towards us. And Russell said, "This is it." So we got the Ruger out. He got throwing knives because that's what he was going to do. "I'm going to shoot the hull and try to sink them, and he'll start stabbing them when they get on." This is normal life on the boat. So they get closer and closer, and they're going flat chat. And as they got closer, you see they're all blokes. Like, it's just bristling with blokes with black balaclavas. And I'm down in the cockpit shaking like a little puppy with this thing I've never fired. And they just do this big broadside. And the boat comes to a sweeping halt, and they just hold up fish. "Hey, Joe, you buy fish?" You think, "I nearly blew you out of the water." I couldn't talk. I just couldn't say a word. Russell had to say something and politely say, "No, thank you, we don't. We need any fish." I was just, speechless.
Why were they wearing balaclavas to sell fish?
So they don't get
fish?
Burned. It's to keep their, Well, they don't expect to see boats out in the water. They just thought, we'll get a lot more money for our fish from a yacht. Yeah. But we weren't to know that, and we were ready for pirates. We'd been told so many stories. "You want to buy fish? Oh my God." Anyway, so that diffused a whole lot of things in us, I guess, because you're out there's nothing to see but water on all sides you for days on end, and then the one dot on the horizon suddenly becomes your greatest fear, and you go through the whole routine of, "I'm going to have to kill people to survive," which is a little bit out of your normal depth. And then they just want to sell you fish. It's probably quite a good reflection on life, really. Like, don't overreact.
Things are different on the ocean, many things. But some things are just like they are on land. Relationships are still hard, and relationships still end, and these endings are still really shitty.
I ran away in Kenya. And it all just got a bit silly, I think, because we'd reached our use-by date. We'd been together in a confined space for way too long. It all just got really silly, to the point where he dropped me off on a dirt road a long way from anywhere and pretty much said, "That's it, you can walk from here." I thought, that's not such a good idea. But I was so cross that I didn't go back to the boat. And that was it. I went back to the boat twice with the help of the local workers telling me when Russell had gone to Mombasa for the day to get some cash to get me home, but also collect my things and to leave a note. And I left the shortest of notes because I thought, we've discussed absolutely everything. There's no more discussion to be had. So it was just like, "Goodbye and thanks for all the fish," or something. The note was only one sentence because there's no more to be said.
And so, after years at sea, that's how it ended. In Kenya, with both feet on the land and a boat she didn't watch sail away.
For more stories from Contact Mike, including a princess watching her grief over her father's death play out on YouTube, a person who can smell the dead wondering if he's gone insane, and a man whose brain damage means that he doesn't remember cheating on his partner, head to contactmikepodcast.com, iTunes, or your favourite podcasting app. You can also listen to the full versions of all the pieces played today. Contact Mike are also on Twitter and Instagram, and if you're having trouble finding them, all the links are on our website, allthebestradio.com. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Selena Shannon. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Bethany Atkinson-Quinton. Tegan Nichols compiles our show. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Beth Gibson is our SYN Production Manager. Michael Bryden is my co-host. And I'm Jess Hamilton. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can also find our archive at allthebestradio.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.